This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Gang, Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with
Andrew, the LA Rabbit,
Kevin, the Whirlwind X.
At least for now. We'll see if we can come up with another configuration later as Andrew departs to C2E2 and we try to rope in Phil from points north.
Can I have a moment of hubris, gentlemen? As you know, we had... Oh, well, I guess I'm not waiting for your permission anyways.
That's what hubris is all about.
As you know, there was the recent WonderCon convention here in sunny Anaheim, California, which I attended. It used to be up in the San Francisco area, but this is the second or third year that they've had it down here in Anaheim. So I went all 3 days, and I've taken up... I really enjoy going to the conventions because I like meeting up with friends. It's fun to and meet the artists and go to panels and all that, but I really like the social aspects of it. And one of my friends has got me into sort of live tweeting the different panels I go to as a way to spread the word, because that's a lot of what he does, especially with San Diego being the big one that we do that at. And so I went to the Valiant Comics panel and was live tweeting up theirs. And then, lo and behold... last night, my friend tells me that Bleeding Cool gave me credit but appropriated one of my Twitter photos that I had taken in live tweet.
And your like, blurry Twitter photos?
My crappy cell phone pics. And they were like, hey, thanks to Andrew Sanford, you know, linked my Twitter, you know, and was talking about the end of Harbinger and everything. And I was like, how about that? I've made it to pseudo non-respectability.
Oh, yeah, here it is. I see they got your sexting pictures, too.
By being on... yeah, those aren't out of focus, unfortunately, for everybody. But
I wish they were.
But it was... yeah, it was... So that had some... Because I wasn't sure if anyone was really paying attention to my...
Oh.
Furiously tweeting the Valiant news coming out.
Hey, but, you got some replies. You were spreading the good Valiant word, and people were replying to you. I saw it.
But so I was like, wow, how about that? Bleeding Cool. That's a website.
It certainly
and anyways,
is.
I thought I'd toot my own horn by saying I've made the non-paid journalism ranks now with yet another forum conquered. But anyways, the Valiant panel was lots of fun. It seems like they're ending a couple series with big issue 25s and then rebooting with limited series. So I think we're going to see more of what people popularly call the Hellboy model, where you have sort of ongoing continuity, but you don't have intimidating numbers on the books.
When did that change? I want someone to tell me a year exactly, like when people got obsessed, you know, with that.
Well, I think the other issue, and this is going to be a cynical moment, is that... it's mainly because their customers are the comic shops, and I think a lot of the comic shops tend to order number ones a bit heavier, so that leads to an encouragement for them to release more number ones. Plus, it seems a more natural point to do a lot of the cover hijinks where they have various variants that also stimulate ordering. So it just seems to be now that the numbers are out, you know, number ones just sell better.
Yeah, I would also like to see, though, a title that would be, like, on the rise with sales, and then they still decide to, like, renumber it. Like, we haven't seen both ends of the spectrum, so I'm like, I wonder if sales were on the rise, if they would still be as willing to, publishers would be as willing to renumber their stuff.
Well, the only book I think you could do that with is Walking Dead, because that's the only one that seems to have... some sort of growth to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. People don't follow that Walking Dead model. That wasn't successful. Of course, that's an exception, but it's, you know, it's funny.
I think it's a wave kind of thing, you know, a cyclical kind of thing where, you know, the numbers, the high numbers become burdensome or seemingly burdensome to, you know, bringing in new readers or having starting on points. And then you get to the point where everything is just a 1 through 5 or 1 through 20, and then it becomes, again, like a badge of honor to, like, reach a high milestone number again, right? And then everyone will slowly go back to all their old numberings, and then it'll all seem too cumbersome. The problem is we have these cyclical, you know, seasons of the people who run these companies getting together and trying to have ideas, and they got to come up with something to do, right? So they go... They go back. It's like pushing the dirt from one side of the parking lot to the other side of parking lot and continuing to get money for construction, you know, at some like hospital or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, they're just kind of, well, Matt, what else could we do? Well, we could move that pile of dirt back to the other side. That's what they do. And in doing so, they give the illusion of there being somewhat of a change and something to hype and to promote marketing wise. And, you know, it's just going back to the other side of the coin.
It's just funny seeing trade paperbacks run into this issue. Oh, we're up to now, like, volume 54. Huh, so the same problem we had with issues is now in trade paperbacks, the number's too high.
Well, so they don't need to worry about... Because they still can... They oftentimes go back to the old numbering, though.
Even though it is technically
a number one at any time... And, you know, they can just say, oh, wait, it's actually now jumping from number 24 to number 600, because that would have been the correct numbering a million years ago.
Warlord of Mars just did that with Dynamite, where there's a storyline I'm reading that goes from 31 to 35. And after issue 34, they came out with issue 200 of
but
Warlord.
But aren't they combining,
And that wasn't related to the storyline. And then a couple of weeks later... the 35 issue comes out that ends the 5-part storyline. So, you know, it can be confusing to a simple-minded folk.
Oh, I was simple-minded. I've been looking through back issue bins and even stuff from the 80s. Some of the numbering is a little wonky and you're like, yeah, that's going to be confusing in the future because even stuff from the 80s is starting to get too much.
I think a series like you were mentioning before, like Walking Dead, I think is one of those ones that enjoys having their high numbering, don't you think? I mean, how about a book like Savage Dragon? I mean, he's proud to have been done that many books and for it to be pushing 200. I don't see them jumping back to number one anytime soon.
No, because you could say, I've been around. This is a stable book. It's not going anywhere.
Especially in the indie world, it can be shown that way, but a lot of books aren't stable, so why try to act that way? Time for another volume of The Darkness.
Yeah. Well, as long as titles keep their like continuities and their subplots going and everything, and it's not really cut and dry, like whatever Valiant has to do, like I'm there. I'm definitely looking forward to like all the stuff they have coming up with Madame Mirage and all that stuff, so... Or Dr. Mirage, I guess.
The other thing I always appreciated that Walking Dead did was they didn't really ever push it. I mean, they push it in the sense that they release in a lot of different formats, but they never had a lot of spin-offs or crossovers or stuff. Where a lot of other properties, the second they get hot, you know, suddenly you're looking at, hey, let's license it here, let's cross it over here, let's have a second or third title. And I think that also makes it great for people because it's pretty easy to direct people to The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You know, do you want it digitally? Do you want it in a trade? Do you want an omnibus? It's all the same issues. Like you start with the first one and work your way up or jump to this one if you want to skip the first one or whatever, as opposed to, oh, yeah, they did this cool crossover with this company or, you know, oh, there were Tales of The Walking Dead or, you know, Walking Dead Adventures or things like that. I think it makes it very simple for someone who watched the show or interested about it to jump in and follow right along.
Do you want it on an oversized artist edition on your smartphone?
Yeah.
I've been reading to catch up on a title that arrived on the scene with a bit of marketing fanfare and seemed like it would be interesting to check out and something that surprisingly we hadn't had on the market in quite some time. There's been about 15 or 16 issues of this series in the can already, and I read them and wasn't really all that enthused, but there were a couple issues that had interesting concepts, and I guess it's not worth trying to really sell you on the book since I didn't really get too excited about it myself reading it, but it's the Star Wars title from Dark Horse that Brian Wood is writing and got a variety of different artists. Really nice covers on all the series, you know, with those exact likenesses done and painted and everything. And what's cool about the series is it's just after episode 4, the first Star Wars movie. So it's right after the Death Star got blown up and Han is still around and he hasn't gone to Cloud City and all that yet. Luke and Leia don't know they're related and all that business, and Darth and Luke haven't yet met. So it's kind of an interesting time to tell stories. It's the Rebellion, they're on the run, they've just made a big hit against the Empire, and Brian Wood's writing it. He's an acclaimed writer, so this sounds cool, right? The art's good enough, and all the characters are there, but some of the stories, they've got kind of Chewie and Han off on a side adventure, and Leia is off on kind of a solo adventure, and then there's stuff kind of going on with the Rebellion, and Proper kind of looking for a base, and the Empire is trying to find its sea legs again after the blow that the Rebels, you know, took against them with the Death Star there, and start getting the next one worked on for the third movie, or sixth, or however the heck you figure it out these days. I don't know. The things that they touch upon just aren't that intriguing. As I'm paging through, things aren't really catching me. They're like, oh, that's a cool thing to do with that, or that feels so neat and Star Wars-y and stuff. I mean, there's Stormtroopers and Darth Vader's squeezing the life out of every underling around him. One thing that was really cool was in issues 9 and 10, they did a two-part story. It doesn't take up the whole issues, but it's you know, one of the stories going on in them is Leia goes off to Alderaan, or the ruins of Alderaan, where her planet was blown up not that long ago, considering this happens right after the Death Star is destroyed. And she's kind of checking out the rubble, is amazed at the size of the you know, asteroid field, if you will, that's there where Alderaan used to be. And she's kind of cruising through, and she finds an old Clone War era, like, pre-Imperial destroyer. You know, one of those big triangular mammoth ships. And there's a dude on there. And he's got, like, he's almost like the collector. And he's, like, collecting all stuff from Alderaan, making the ship be, like, this floating tomb of a museum of as much Alderaan history and culture as could be collected, either from debris floating around or whatever he could gather elsewhere in the galaxy and stuff. It turned, he is befriending her and realizes that she's, you know, she's freaking Princess Leia. this was your planet. Holy cow. He's taking care of her ship a little and trying to tell her the deal. And turns out he's a defected scientist for the Empire. Not only that, he's a weapons manufacturer for the Empire who's defected, and he's the guy who designed the weapons system that blew up Alderaan. So he feels pretty guilty about the whole thing, and he's floating around his penance, basically, trying to collect things and whatnot, and he expects and hopes that Leia's going to kill him, but he just wants her to have, like, all the stuff to make sure that it's, you know, maintained and that the culture kind of goes on, which was kind of a cool setup. And it's like, yeah, that's the kind of thing you should do. Some kind of interesting tie-in to the old mythology stuff that doesn't step on any toes anywhere. And then she ends up leaving him, that punishment is worse, you know, to leave him with his sin, you know, that whole bit. And a few issues later, in issue 14, Vader, in chasing down Princess Leia, comes across that dude and ends his story in looking for Leia, even though he doesn't give Leia up. You know, that kind of a concept was cool, but I'm just not seeing enough of that elsewhere in it to really jive me. Have you guys read it at all?
Well, I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan, but I heard some cool things, like, you know, I think there was a spy story or something going on there, so I was like, oh, it sounds kind of... But, you know, still. Takes me a long time before I'll get something like that.
I read maybe the first 5 issues. I enjoyed the art. I thought it's always a difficult balance capturing likenesses but not being too close to it. You know, kind of still, I don't want it to be like some kind of Photoshop.
Right.
But I thought the art, and I particularly liked, they did the Darth Vader trick, like Spider-Man, where his mask sometimes shows more emotion than it should.
Yeah.
And I liked that. But my problem was it just felt like the stories weren't the tone of the movies. And so it was more of almost an academic interest. Like, I like the first movie as my favorite. Or the fourth one. The
first one.
The one where Luke's a hillbilly out in the sticks.
Right.
And he's getting out of there. That's the one I like the most. Yeah. And I think that Wood decided to do these other things and tell these other sorts of stories that just didn't fit that tone. And I think for other people that would be fine, but because I like that movie, I like the feel of it, I would want stories consistent with the feel. I felt that, like, to go back to the first adaptation, the Marvel Comics one, I felt those captured sort of the crazy space adventure, but still had the Empire being very menacing. Where this was more almost a procedural military book in a way. And I know that it's a military story, but I still want a flavor of that adventure that tempted me.
And in the three issues, I mean, like you said about the likenesses, very much like Dark Horse did the Buffy, the Vampire Slayer comic books, where you totally know who each character is, but no one's trying to do a dead-on. No one's being, you know, having their hands tied by doing likenesses, which is good. But in the three issues I mentioned, 9, 10, and 14, there's three different pencilers. Ryan Kelly, Carlos De Anda, and Facundo Paricio. So, you know, that's a problem when it's going to be bouncing all over the place. But I guess they're not going to have the Star Wars license much longer with Marvel looming in the wings.
Yeah, I think it's officially announced that in 2015 it reverts. But on the first ones, I think it was all the Dahlia was the pencil. And like I said, I liked it. It just, you know, you want to get me with Star Wars, I need that kind of space adventure. There should be a real twist of adventure into it and a real, we're going. And also, I really like the wackiness. Like, Star Wars was a crazy place. The canteen scene has a bit of silliness to it. You know, it's not a serious drama. It's an old West bar populated with weird-looking creatures with giant heads and no robots, but it needs that Western feel, too.
He says he don't like you.
I don't like you.
I don't like you either.
Yeah, that time, you know, and I just thought that there was that missing kind of fun to it that I want in Star Wars. But I would say that, you know, it certainly seemed like competently executed and interesting stories. They just weren't what I was looking for. I also started the Gabriel Hardman, Karina Bechko Star Wars title, which is not set anywhere near the same time period.
Yeah, it's a new edition of Legacy. Yeah. That's hundreds of years in the future of Star Wars.
Yeah, and I'm always confused at the Star Wars mythology. I read some of the novels and played a few of the video games, but I would probably fail a Star Wars history test. Most assuredly.
Yeah.
I just read recently Bad Houses, a Dark Horse original graphic novel. This is one I picked up at Emerald City, and it's the by Sarah Ryan and Carla Speed McNeil. Sarah Ryan and Steve Lieber, one of those comic book powerhouse couples, and I have always liked Carla Speed McNeil, but I'm sadly ignorant of too much of her work. So I thought this was an excellent opportunity to pick up and, you know, check a couple boxes and get some more excellent work. And it's also one of these, it's not a memoir, but it's like a realistic setting. And it's the story of, first of all, I guess I should start, any of you guys familiar with, like, dislike either of those two creators?
Should I get into this?
Yes, you should.
Yeah.
No, I just tried, what was it, Finder before? And I remember reading like the quote on the cover, like Warren Ellis is like, this comic's so innovative on every page. So maybe that was setting up the series incorrectly, because then I turned to the first page, and of course every thought is, oh, this is going to be an innovative page. I'm like, oh, splash page. Oh, just regular storytelling. Splash page. But anyways, I got maybe 50 pages into it, and it just did nothing for me. It was like one of those rare occasions. Like, I can count on one hand how many comics I've started and then never got through. Like, I usually finish stuff even if it's pretty bad. I don't know. I guess if it would have been terrible, then I would have said, this is so terrible, I have to finish this, maybe. But it was just sort of, not that it was offensive or anything like that. It was just, I don't know. I guess it bored me a bit.
Its lack of offense was offending.
Yeah, apparently. I guess you want a reaction, like, one way or the other, and this was just sort of like, yeah, this isn't my thing. So I just let it go rather than prolong the experience.
Well, I will let you guys know that this is, I saw Sarah Ryan at WonderCon afterwards and remarked to her how much I really enjoyed the book, but how much I also liked the lettering. And she said Carla Speed McNeil did the lettering. And she also mentioned that the book is up for an Eisner for the lettering. So if you like nice lettering, this is one of the books to check out. And I thought that was kind of an interesting twist that I really noticed it. And then retroactively, I guess I'm not alone. And that the Eisner people also like the lettering. But that seems like an awkward transition. Steve, any comments on either of these two creators before I lay out the book?
No, teach me.
Okay, we have a rural Oregon town. And we have a mother and son business, and their job is disposing of decedent's estates. So when, presumably in most cases, it's a small town, so it's an aged person passes, they have their will disposes of their estate for the most part, but they also have a whole bunch of regular possessions, you know, like beds and mirrors and books and things. And so whatever's not given a particular line item in a will, they will offer to go in and arrange the sale. So, you know, if you're going to inherit, you take whatever sentimental items you'd want, but for the most part, presumably you're not going to want to take everything, because then you'd have two sets of dishes and two sets of everything. So this is a company, and they go in and put the prices on everything, and then there are these weekend sales. And I guess it can be quite cutthroat, because, you know, you have antiques dealers and the like trying to get the good deals, like any type of garage sale or things.
Wait, hold up. You mean you can't take it with you?
Well, I plan on, you know, obviously having all my comics buried with me, but
your artist editions,
my artist editions, they're going to make the coffin out of artist editions.
Oh, there you go.
Probably better made than most.
And, I'll be buried in it. So, and then that's one half. And then the other side is this, daughter who lives with her mother, and her mother is a bit of a hoarder type. And they end up crossing paths because the daughter ends up at the estate sale. And it's kind of the two of them just going through and finding each other and the different adventures that they have. So it's kind of a nice slice of life. There is a story and an arc, and the characters change. So it's not completely just empty kind of, here's a day in the life. Not that that's not a good thing, but I'm not into that. Those comics where nothing happens, so to speak. Like, I want my characters to go through some sort of transformation. I just really thought it was an interesting, like, it's not a world I had thought of. And the author talks about how she came across this world about estate sales and everything and found it an interesting thing, you know, how people are trying to get these things and how they work that system and just what it must, you know, the kind of headspace it puts you in. And then Carla Speed McNeil in this one, what I've liked about it is it's very, I don't know, I just think she does a lot of kind of sparse work. Like, the backgrounds are super busy, but the figure work is very, not a lot of lines at all. which I kind of enjoy. Because I like looking... I'm kind of at times fascinated when artists can use as few strokes as possible to convey the most information. I guess it's a bit of an intellectual exercise, but I'm always amazed at that. How if you break it down, there, you know, a face can really be just maybe four or five lines, but that can communicate so much. And I think she really does that. But like I said, the backgrounds can oftentimes be pretty detailed with little cross-hatching or the patterns on the clothes and everything. And I think that by having the relatively simple faces against those patterns, it really makes them pop. Now, when there's old people, like the woman's mother works in a nursing home, they have a lot more lines because obviously that connotates the wrinkles. And there's a kid with a bunch of freckles. But mostly, the faces are those kind of clean faces I like. So I just really enjoyed it, but it doesn't have any kind of superheroes or strange events happening or anything.
Cool.
I guess I didn't give a resounding sale to it, but I enjoyed it. Like I said, I just thought it was funny that I really enjoyed the lettering. And then it turns out it's being nominated for an Eisner for lettering.
That's kind of a weird category nowadays.
Well, I'm glad it's still around. I'm a big fan of the few remaining holdouts that take the time to add into the work. It's just something you kind of note because the lettering can influence the feel of the book in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. But I failed to mention last episode when I was talking about the Richard Sala stuff, that his hand lettering is really graphic, and all of his S's have like concentric swirly swirls at the end of all the arcs and things, and the art, it's very dreamlike and wavy, and it adds to the gothic horror aspect and the intimate creator's touch of his work, and it's all just from the lettering piece of it. So I hear you, man. I hear you.
Yeah, and besides, what are the odds I was going to randomly hit an Eisner nominee? Like, it's not, I don't have any, I don't, I just, it's not something that's just generally on my radar either. I don't hate on the Eisners or love on them, it's just not something I'm drawn to for some reason. I probably should get into the Eisners. I'm sure I'm missing some real gems, but it just feels like I have enough to read through my own discoveries that I'm not hurting for lack of material.
It's like when I'll go to TCAF, I'll pick up some random book, and then I'll be like, oh, wow, this was really an award winner. I had no idea.
Our pal Tim, the Freaky Tiki, on our forums, he always reads all the Eisners every year, or at least that's used to be his behavior the last time I asked him.
Yeah.
But it makes for a fun, interesting reading list to expose yourself to a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, because I don't think you'll necessarily enjoy everything, but you'll know what's out there and you'll, you know.
Well, there really are so many different categories, too. I mean, that...
Yeah, he's probably just picking the obvious ones.
Yeah, those series and stuff. Because, I mean, you know, it goes into all these, you know, best international material, best...
That's where the good stuff is, remember?
Best comics-related periodical journalism, best comics-related book, those sorts of things, which could best scholarly slash academic work.
Yeah, depending upon which categories or where your tastes lie, yeah, some of those categories might be a slog.
Well, just it's a huge volume of material.
Yeah.
That's a lot of, and in addition to we all have regular piles of books, at least I'm reading. I imagine you guys are the same, so it feels like we're not hurting for that. But I do like that out of the five nominees for archival collection, we've got three artist editions.
That was ridiculous.
I mean, and good on them. Those are.
Yeah.
I have a ton of them. I mean, I've cut back a little bit since the madness that they've come out with so many.
Yeah, but show me a better book. You know,
exactly. Me in. I mean, they're just, I can't stress to the listener, start with like one of those portfolios. You can get them kind of on the cheap and that'll give you a feel for it. But it just really gives you a sense of appreciation, especially if you're someone like me who's not an artist. by looking at it in the full size, it lets you more easily envision how they go about creating these things. I think if you're an artist, you might not need it because you can just look at the finished product and deconstruct it in your head.
It's even funner to deconstruct the original pencils when you can. I mean, I love at cons just opening up the big black binders, folders at portfolios at the various tables and flipping through original artwork and looking at it and being able to have a big volume of it at a relatively affordable price is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, basically one of those volumes probably wouldn't get you a page of a lot of books out of a lot of things. So while it seems expensive, if you have the space and the resources, it's really something that you can it increases your appreciation.
And they're also replicated in color, so you get the yellowness of the pages and all.
And some of them have some color plates at the WonderCon. During the IDW Artist Edition panel, they had the printer's proof of the Kirby one, and there's one, at least one color plate in there where it's a full color. Plus, they had gatefold outs and everything. That Kirby New Gods one is going to look really tremendous, and that's when they broke the news that they're doing a Buscema Silver Surfer and a Marvel Covers. It's been interesting, the Hellboy one, he broke down and admitted that it was the first one where they've included a modern, some of it's modern, so there's no word balloons.
Yeah.
And Dunbeer said he wasn't ruling that out in the future, but I have a feeling that's going to be pretty rare. First of all, his heart, I think, belongs to those older books to begin with. Not that he doesn't appreciate new stuff, but obviously this is a partly business, partly passion project. So I think that, and also the accessibility, most modern comic artists now are smart. They keep copies or they know what's happened to their work. In fact, he said for the Mazzucchelli Daredevil, Mazzucchelli had already scanned all that stuff in himself a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already, practically ready to go, just clean it up. And also there'll be plenty of different options for the Starenko one coming out. Like at least three or four. There's ones that have big sketches, little sketches, different, slip cases, all that stuff. But Starenko is doing the design work. Normally, he's the first one that's actually taken that step. So they're waiting on him to finish. But if you want to spend some money, you'll be able to. I'm sure those ones with the big sketches are not going to be cheap. But Starenko, obviously, most famously, Shield and Captain America work, for those unaware.
I was rereading The Hobbit, Tolkien's Hobbit, and have a little guide to Middle Earth paperback that's set up like a little encyclopedia. It's almost like parts of the internet printed on pages. but that's a great little guide to flip through, and I always catch myself cross-referencing things, characters, looking them up, and then it mentions something else, and I go look that up, and then I'm just bouncing around, and I have myself a fun little Tolkien-y Middle-Earth time. And in the back, I happened to flip through the ads in the back of that paperback, which has to be from almost 10 years ago, and in it mentioned was an ad for the Hobbit graphic novel, adapted by Chuck Dixon, with art by David Wenzel. And I'm like, David Wenzel? Is that the same David Wenzel that did, like, the Korvac saga for the Avengers way back in the mid-70s? Yeah, it is. And when I was at a comics from the mid to late 80s, there was two issues published of The Hobbit, or There and Back Again, right? Adapted by Chuck Dixon and illustrated by Wenzel. And it's been reprinted a couple of times. I forget the actual date, but it was reprinted in a nice hardcover, and there was added a bunch of additional pages and stuff. And that's the copy that I ordered when I saw the ad for it. And it's beautifully illustrated. It doesn't look like anything I would have connected to Wenzel's old pencil and ink work. What it is it's thin ink line and watercolor. So the coloring is all watercolor stuff and thin ink line edges and stuff. Not a lot of blacks at all, and done in the classic style in the 80s. This isn't all done on a computer kind of thing. So it's really has a almost reminds me almost of some of the Bashki, you know, animated stuff. If you want to think of it that way, Bilbo himself has a very red nose. It made my 10-year-old laugh. That like, oh, that's supposed to be Bilbo. But it's the story of the Hobbit, really beautifully illustrated and a real fine adaptation by Dixon, who throws in you know, plenty of good lines from Tolkien. You know, make sure to mention when he's riding the eagle that the great eagle was said to be able to stare right into the sun, and you know, that was old lore about eagles that they had eyes that could stare into the sun and not have them burned out, but obviously that isn't true. But just throwing in all these little Tolkienisms that made it for a great read, and the pacing really done well, especially if you're used to the movie pacing where all the padding was thrown in. It's about almost 150 pages, I want to say. And like I said, real nice color palette where the bodies are real warm, but the landscapes, for the most part, and Gandalf are all more of the blues and purples and stuff, except where you're in the Shire, and grays. So it really gives you that fish out of water kind of feeling that here you are, this like warm body in this kind of cold, unknown environment. But it's the story that is a great prequel to The Lord of the Rings, and cool when you think of the whole thing together and realize that Gandalf was, you know, foreseeing some of the incidents that would happen in Lord of the Rings trilogy, and was wanting to really make sure that there was a strong kingdom in the north. And that's the story that you don't hear about in the Lord of the Rings stuff. They have the big battle in the south there, but all the Easterlings and all the nonsense from Dol Guldur in Mirkwood that was all going on in the north, all that was handled by a unified, strong elf, human, and new dwarf, you know, community, because they got rid of Smaug up there. The spoiler, they got rid of the dragon and, you know, reformed their old kingdom there, their dwarf kingdom in the Lonely Mountain. So those northerners had like a battle that happened at the same time as what was happening in Lord of the Rings. And that was Gandalf's impetus for the whole Hobbit quest, and putting that idea in the dwarves' heads of like, you know, you should go reclaim your gold, and just setting those pieces in place. And those of you who read Hickman or like those long form kind of big world building ideas, this is the guy who is one of the first to really give it to us in pop culture. Tolkien.
That sounds very good. The Hobbit's always fun because you can take it so many different ways. Kevin, you want to talk about Flowers of Evil?
Oh, what?
Baby snakes. All right, we've let Andrew head off to his own brand of misadventures at C2E2, and we've regrouped, adding Phil. Woohoo! Hi, Phil.
Hello.
What do you got, Phil? Let's put you on the spot.
I can't talk about it too much, but I was recently, I caught up on Invincible, a big chunk, issue 104 to 110.
Wow.
And I found it zapped me, like, right back into it. Like, now I'm definitely reading it month to month.
All right.
Wasn't there some big happenings recently?
Issue 108.
Challenge.
Yeah, issue 108 is the issue. That's something insane happens, and the upcoming storyline is going to be amazing. I wish I could talk about it so bad, but it's too big, these spoilers.
I read in a like a master, just reading through all the trades. It's
the best
way.
Issues,
but then I was like at 100. I was caught up to the new issue. You know, I was like, all right, I'm gonna wait for a few to build up. But now you got me excited to read it.
Yeah, you definitely have to read this. And also, you should try out the minis and stuff too, like the Adam and Eve and the Rex ones, because those tie in really well, and they're all great minis.
Well, don't they have that other series that's like Invincible
Global
Universe?
And, yeah, there's that. There's the Global Guardians.
Yeah.
Like, they're all great companion pieces. And I love the Invincible Universe just because it's so contained. And it feels like I have years of characters and origins and stuff.
Yeah, the only complaint I had about the series was that sometimes it trends too much on, like, other companies, like, you knowing the tropes of superheroes,
Well, I don't know, because all the big shocks are stuff I don't see in it, like the 108 issue.
Yeah, it just mean like the serpent group or something. It's like, oh, this is a serpent group, you know, like those other serpent animal groups.
That's
and I'm
for
like,
fun, though. That's
yeah.
making fun. I like that kind of stuff for sure.
or then at the beginning, they didn't seem to have a whole lot of origins for the characters, but then they got there eventually, so, mm-hmm. you know.
I don't know. I find if anyone stopped reading it, it's definitely, should definitely check it out again.
I think I read up to issue 60 or something.
Oh, God.
That's it? Yikes.
Yeah, I have two, like, here to read. I just haven't read them.
I'm pretty sure the big collections are not that bad of a price. Like,
yeah, that's what I buy.
Yeah.
Cool. I think Otley is going to be at Boston Comic Con this August that I'm going
to. I'd love to get a sketch by him.
Yeah.
That is awesome stuff. Yeah, I love his sketches.
And they always have those sketches in the back of the hardcovers, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, with their comments and stuff. Very
yes.
good.
What does this sound like? Knife skills, 16 new ways to slice, dice, chop, and butcher.
A Kevin comic.
Scrapbooking, preserve the memories you want. 17 ideas to liven up your love life. How to avoid conversation killers.
This doesn't sound up your alley. Body.
This sounds like something you'd be interested in.
What are you reading, Kevin?
Mind management.
Ah.
I realized that.
You mean mind management?
Well, yeah. I didn't want to go there. It's really mind MGMT.
Management.
Exactly. But I realized I had 6 issues stacked up, you know, due to other concerns, other podcasting. So I noticed that with issue 21, they're coming out with, like, the silent issue, you know, in the tradition of, like, G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I really want to read that, but, you know, I had a stack of other ones to read. Yeah. And I guess it was because I read one issue or a couple issues of this romance arc that was the third arc, and that was, like, my favorite issue of, like, last year. So I'm like, I don't know if anything could keep up with that. So I guess I took a break after that point. But they had some really creepy romance stories, and they had the cover set up like it's, like, an old magazine. And just, like, crazy stuff went down. Crazy people were murdered. And then I'm like, whoa, wait a second. But anyways, I'm all caught up now. And what I love about the issues is they have all these extras, like, using the front cover and then the last few pages in the issue, where they'll introduce, like, new agents. So they, like, basically, I guess if someone doesn't know what mind management or mind murder is, like, there was this plane where it had all this people on it, and they landed somewhere, and no one, like, really remembered what had gone on in the plane. So you find out there's these two organizations that are sort of competing with each other right now, and they have, like, these crazy mind skills. Like, someone will be able to, like, not be able to, they won't sleep anymore. They'll have studied some animal or something. And they'll be like, yeah, I can do the skill that only dolphins could do, and now I don't have to sleep, and I'm the greatest agent, or someone will be able to wipe someone's mind. Basically all, like, mind-crazy type of skills. Or someone will be able to figure out how to make some imaginary object or weapons. Or, like, someone will be able to shoot you by, you know, making their hand look like a gun, and then, like, mind bullets.
And I know it's a Kevin recommendation, but I read the first trade, and it's really good, actually.
So if my craziness, you know, doesn't influence you.
Haven't read any of this yet, but it's been on my wish list.
There's some nice hardcovers out. It's just they take up a lot of book space.
Yeah, the pages are pretty thick. And the regular issues are kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of like brownish, kind of pulpy paper. And they even have, like, the lines, you know, where you see the blue lines on a page, like the artist is only supposed to draw up to a certain point. It's like the bleed-off point. Well, they have, like, those lines around the pages. And then when you turn the comic sideways, they have, like, another story going in the margins.
Weird.
But it starts getting really crazy in some of these issues, because in one of the issues I read, towards the end of the romance arc, like, this person can't... They can't really see certain people because their mind has been wiped too many times. But the way that's shown is like, it's like basically like they were cut out of the issue, like someone took scissors. So their mind starts, like the mind wiping starts wearing off so they can sort of half see people. It's just really creepy and really effective. So you might see someone in black and white and it'll be like they were pasted onto the issue and they're like, am I seeing something or not?
Weird.
So they like start going like really crazy, and then horrible murders happen again. It seems like the common theme of every issue is like horrible murders.
Can you say murders again?
Yes.
Murders.
Murders. Murders.
You always said that one time.
Possibly. But I feel like I've been mind managed after reading this.
This is the type of story, though, I don't want to go on for too long, though. What, like, does it feel like it's going to have an ending at some point soon?
Yeah, there's only supposed to be, like, a couple more arcs. I think the entire series is supposed to go maybe 32 or 36
okay.
issues.
That's a good amount for a story like this.
Because they're already ramping up with just, like, issue 17, like, where two of the groups meet up. Like, you have this part where mind management was shut down. They were too powerful. It's like they would put words into the newspapers and people would read those words and then start killing each other. So they were too powerful and they disbanded. But now someone's like trying to bring agents together again. And there's also a person out there called the Eraser, and they're like erasing people's minds and erasing things.
Yep.
So you basically have the rebel agents that just wanted to have a regular life versus the Eraser, who is like recruiting old agents again. And like the conclusion to this arc is just them basically killing each other and horrible things happened. Like basically you have a lot of wide panels or double page spreads. And even in the, I think the third hardcover, there's these four pages that you can tell are connected together, but they're not like a foldout. But in the collection, they're supposed to be like a four-page foldout. So I'm like, that's just going to be
completely... In the collection. Awesome. It's in the collection.
But it's supposed to be a foldout.
Yeah.
So I'm like, that's just going to be, oh, just so good.
Or in the first one, didn't they have something like that?
I don't think so.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of a different one, but I thought they had a foldout.
I don't know. Because I read it in issues and then bought the hardcover again, so I'm not as familiar with the hardcover.
Yeah.
And I love all the extras.
Yeah, it's a nice hardcover, but just like I say, too thick, though.
Yeah, it's a bit thick. And then by the time you get to the fourth story arc, oh, there's a single issue between the third and fourth story arc, and it's basically someone that can feel animals. So
that
they're
sounds,
like talking.
That sounds dirty. Go on.
So they it's not like they can talk, but they can sort of communicate somehow.
Show
so
me
they know
the animal where he touched you.
I guess. I don't know, it's hard to explain, but like the animals are really keen on them, like this kid. So they like go to the zoo and the animals like start breaking out of the zoo saying, "Hey, we want to come along with you," and everything. So apparently they need a lot of therapy. But eventually, like one of the people from mind management finds them. So they go to this camp. They learn how to use these abilities. But then mind management starts making them do like the craziest stuff, like, "Oh, well, we want you to make sure this dog will tape, like, explosives to his body and bring them to people's houses and, like, blow up anything they want." And so you see all these creepy things, like dolphins with, like, a vest and, like, parrots and everything, and it's just like, wow. So eventually this kid, like, finds out none of their animal friends are coming back. So they find a better way this can be done. But it takes way more work. It's way more intensive, but they like start sabotaging things without blowing themselves up. And it's even funny at some points where they start saying like certain animals are smarter than others. Like the koala bear, they're like, "I don't want to say this animal is dumb, but it takes a long time to talk to him, and he really doesn't get what's going on." Like they've been basically going around, like every issue you're introduced to another agent, and you see if they're going to get recruited or not, or horribly murdered. And it's even funny, since Matt Kint writes Unity for Valiant Comics, they did a sort of like an ad swap. So there's like an ad for Unity on the back cover of one of these mind management issues, but it's like one of the characters.
Bendis used to do that in Powers. He'd advertise for his other companies. I think when you
but
do
did
it
he draw the ads, though?
Oh.
Like he's drawing a character from mind management that knows about Valiant Comics,
oh, okay.
And he's trying to make characters or people that have abilities like the characters that are in Valiant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, wow, that is like the craziest ad crossover to something else you're writing at another company.
Weird.
Yeah. So this is all building up to that Silent issue I wanted to read.
or look at.
So they get into the latest arc, which is about like someone that's a magician. And since they have all these crazy like illusion skills, they're like really old, but everyone sees them as really young. So they've been, I guess, having these gigs like around the world type of thing where they can just confuse the audience. But if there's someone that knows about their abilities, I could like really mess up their life. And it's done in a unique way. Like one of the issues, it's like color coded. It's like it has like a purple section, a pink section, and a yellow section. And you need this because the sections that are in the colors are following different groups of people. So you see like the magician like on the left-hand side. And that's like it's like it was ripped out of a book and glued in beside the right-hand section. And then the right-hand section follows three groups of people as they're trying to find this magician and like recruit them to their team. That's just cool. This crazy inventive stuff.
Very neat. How many? So by the time you get now? To
the... He's not done.
So by the time you get to the silent issue, it's silent in a way. Like, I wanted to see how they were going to do a silent issue and not, you know, sort of get around that trope.
This was all built up to the silent issue?
Yes, it is. But you read everyone's thoughts. Like, there's no one talking in the entire issue.
That's funny.
So it's really silent, but you're just reading about, oh, I gotta really shoot this guy, or, oh, man, I gotta avoid that guy's mind bolts or stuff. And it's just horribly violent as people are just thinking through all these different fights.
Funny.
I'm like, that is just mind-blowing. So, yes, I feel like I've been very mind-managed after this. And you find out about all their, like, secret hideouts and safe houses that they go to in the case files that are in the back. So you know like that restaurant that always seems closed downtown or something? Or you feel like going there, nope. And then you find out, oh, I didn't think they were closed at this hour. Like, never that's that the mind management safe house. Like any closed down business or suspicious place like that, and you think, is that place ever open? You better look out for that place. That's been mind managed.
Touché. It turns out he did read the silent issue.
Of course.
How many issues is out of this whole series already? How far down the pike is it?
17, I believe you said.
Oh, cool. 21 is the silent issue. So it seems to be ramping up to its final two arcs. And then I assume that Kint will have another crazy, wildly imaginative series at Dark Horse. Amongst the 8 other titles, it seems like he's writing. But I'm always impressed. And he's usually been at the Toronto Comic Arts Festival every year. Like, I usually get something off of him, like original artwork or a book or something.
Cool.
Well, up next I have Star Trek, this Alien Spotlight. Do you guys ever read, like, when IDW puts out, like, spotlights for Transformers or Star Trek or anything like that?
Okay, I bought some of the John Byrne spotlight. Was it Romulan? And
I like those, yeah, because then you get some nice one-shot stories there.
Right.
Are you a fan of the old Star Trek, Steve?
Oh, yeah.
Can you give me a history on the Tribbles?
Well, it was just the classic episode of The Trouble with Tribbles, right, where they encounter in the kind of overhead luggage rack all the Tribbles, and they multiply, and it's kind of the precursor to the Gremlins movies of the 80s where you just add water and they multiply uncontrollably. Well, that's kind of happens to the Tribbles, and Kirk is covered with them, and there was a great photo novel even in the late 70s of that episode, and I had that and poured through it, and they eventually had to figure out how to void the ship of them.
And you know Klingons don't like Tribbles.
But so that was the only episode that ever happened.
No, Deep Space Nine. Didn't they have something with Tribbles?
I never watched Deep Space Nine other than maybe one episode, so I couldn't tell you. I watched regular Star Trek and Next Generation.
Just seems such a shame that they didn't use them more.
Well, I thought there was some story about like Klingons like killing Tribbles. And then it might have been in the flashback, like when the Deep Space Nine crew was inserted into original Star Trek episode.
Well, Klingons are in this story, the spotlight.
Yeah.
Basically, the spotlight's about, I think they're Starfleet Academy people, I don't know. They're not wearing uniforms or anything, but they're stuck on this planet infested with these Tribbles, like they're everywhere. And there's these Klingons after them, and there's only one working ship. And through this whole battle, the Tribbles are helping them out, helping out the humans or whatever they are. by fighting the Kleons, like attacking them, eating them, and freeing up the ship for them, stuff like that. I thought it was a pretty neat story. It made me want to kind of dive into the Tribbles more, but I guess I can't. Because they don't seem to be used very much.
But it's that one episode that everyone remembers.
Yeah.
I definitely saw it a long time ago, but...
It's sillier than you'll remember it. You'll realize why they haven't been used again.
Yeah.
I just like the idea of them. I've always liked little creatures like that attacking groups and...
Like zombies.
I used to draw a lot of characters like that when I was a kid.
Toupees?
Little,
sentient toupees?
Little balls. Little old man balls. With teeth.
Hey, was it you guys or was it Andrew who mentioned that Starlight book?
That was Andrew, I think.
Did you guys read that?
Yeah, I read the first issue recently.
I read the first two of them. It's Mark Miller, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm waiting for the movie.
It seems like he's redeeming himself after a sort of a weird in-between period there.
I thought this was a really cool little concept. I was going to mention that I had read it and found it to be quite enjoyable. It's like if you like the Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon type trope, it's a pretty clever take on it, even though it's not purely original take on it. But it's like the old guy who was the Earthling who went to the other dimension and fell in love with the interdimensional princess and fought the big battle and was the big hero and everything. Well, he comes back to Earth and nobody believes that he really had those adventures, and he is kind of a laughing stock and he's kind of an old drunk and his life really isn't going anywhere too exciting, and he just has his old memories. And as he kind of hits rock bottom, a emissary of the, you know, intergalactic race that he had connected with comes and says, like, you know, we need you. Everything's gone to shit, you know. You got to come back and help us out, and you're the big hero. And he's like, I'm an old man. What are you talking about? And then he kind of takes a look around, and he realizes, to hell with it. And he puts the old uniform on, and he gets in the thing, and he's like, all right, let's go back, and let's see if I can be of help to somebody, because I'm pretty useless here. And it's kind of a cool midlife crisis kind of take on it. And the old warhorse getting called back in for one more job. It has that angle to it. It has, like I said, a lot of standard tropes, but they're put together. And I really like Gordon Parlov's very simple line type storytelling. I think his, you know, alien architecture and his line works really well for that kind of palace, flowing robe type. I'm used to seeing him doing the weaponry of the Punisher, you know, so it's kind of neat to see him cutting loose in this kind of a tale. So I'm definitely going to be checking it out.
It seems like a very pulpy type of idea for to go off world to another place and do something and then come back.
I like those type of stories a lot, for sure.
Yeah, like you're John Carter or you're Flash Gordon or whatever.
But it's like you can't go back. You can't go back to your youth. You can't go back to your heyday. Or can you? You know, or can you, even as an old man, can you, you know, can, is it just your mind that's holding you back and the cruddy surroundings that you're in? You know, could you still feel as vibrant as you felt? You know, I still feel like I'm the kid I was in high school. I'm just older. You know what I mean? I'm lucky in that way that I still feel like a big kid. And talking with you guys about comic books every couple of weeks certainly helps perpetuate that idea. But it's a fun bunch of material for him to be approaching in this way. And again, for it to be visually also pleasing. Spot on.
And there's a movie coming out.
Is there a movie that isn't coming out for one of his properties?
No. I like his comics, though. Like, I'm a big fan. I like Kick-Ass and all those. Or that one with the Devil Monkey. I enjoyed that one. Superior, I think it was called.
That had a Devil Monkey in it?
Yeah, it was awesome.
Oh, weird.
He was like an astronaut Devil Monkey.
Are you sure this wasn't Planet of the Apes or something?
No.
Oh, jeez.
Give us another pick, Kevin.
I've been making my way through the Black Beetle. Are you familiar with this?
Yep.
Friend,
is it Frank Avila? The Flash writer that writes it?
No.
No? Oh.
It's regular. How do you say that? We usually praise Afterlife with Archie for Frank Avila and everything, and he's doing the, you know, his own character here, his own pulp hero, the Black Beetle, for Dark Horse.
Oh, I thought that was an old character.
No. Okay. This, like, it seems like he's read and watched, like, a lot of pulp stuff. He's into that stuff. And then he made a character that seems to fit seamlessly, like, into that era of, like, jazz clubs and mobsters and all that type of stuff.
Yep.
And yeah, as good as his stuff is on like Afterlife of the Archie, yeah, this is just as good. It's like World War II stuff where like Nazis are coming over to America and trying to like steal ancient artifacts, and like he's there to stop them. And I'm not quite like I'm not done the whole story yet, but the one they did for Dark Horse Presents doesn't seem to tie in a whole lot into the main story yet, but I'm sure it'll get there. But it's kind of cool seeing him doing all this pulp stuff, and then he goes out there to like kill all the gangsters or bring some people to justice, and it's like someone's one step ahead of him the whole time in the story. And it's like a guy, his name is like Labyrinth. It's like a labyrinth, but it's like a labyrintho. It's just like cool stuff like that. And it's like jetpacks and backpacks and people with guns. And
is this published by Archie?
No, by Dark Horse.
It's Dark Horse, okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure if Frankaville had a thing going with them.
I'm not sure if it's part of... I don't see it on here. I assumed it might have been part of their original creators, original Visions line.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess this is their type of thing that they're leaning on more now since they're losing the Star Wars license. So they've been bringing in a lot more like original books and like superhero stuff and everything. And this is sort of superhero-ish in a way. But you know, the way that pulp stuff kind of is, I'd almost say it's like Incognito that Brubaker did with Sean Phillips. But this is like in a different vein, not quite as like graphic, but it's very cool so far.
Sounds good.
I got one good one here. I recently picked up the trade for Rat Queens.
Oh.
And it's only $10 for 5 issues.
Mm.
That's by Image. Usually they put out the first trades, I think, at a good price.
Yeah. For a lot of their stuff, yeah, but not everyone.
Yeah, and maybe any fans of Skull Kickers would probably like this. I find it feels like they're in the same universe, pretty much, but except this is like the female version almost. It's basically, in the start of this trade, there's these four posters for all the characters. Like, there's Violet, who's a dwarven fighter, basically. They're all drunks, and they curse, and sex addicts. Like, they're definitely... there's Hannah, who's a conjurer. Dee, who's, like, a cleric. And then the steal of the show is Betty, this little goblin thief. Like, just any scene with her, she steals the show. Like, it's pretty funny or mysterious, and... It's basically them, they're mercenaries, and someone's put a hit out on all the mercenary teams. And so it's them trying to uncover that.
Cool.
And it's, it's them battling orcs, and you see a lot of, not a lot, but there's some cool gore and stuff too.
Hmm.
It's definitely worth picking up.
I've seen a lot of pictures with, like, girls wearing t-shirts from that series.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm thinking it. It might appeal to a different audience, I'm not sure.
I would love to see a crossover with Skull Kickers. That's a series I haven't picked up all of yet, but I want to catch up on that one.
What's the deal with that? I've never read Skull Kickers.
It's basically kind of like almost like an RPG or like LARPing type world. But yeah, like, sure. No, it's a fantasy world, but they kind of, like, they'll put in the back stats if you wanted to make a character or whatever.
But the dwarf has a machine gun, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the thing. But it's basically a fantasy world where it's just this dwarf and this other guy that go around on these fantasy-type adventures. A lot of comedy. That's what I like about it.
Yeah, it very much seems like a role-playing type of thing. Like, if you were playing with your friends, like, these adventures could have happened.
Mm-hmm. And Rat Queens has a lot of comedy in it, so that's what always gets me.
You know what came out?
What's that?
A new volume of Flowers of Evil. Yes.
You say that every episode. Are you going to talk about it?
That's why I feel like I'm trolling.
What is it?
It's a weird series. It's like a high school series.
What makes it coming back?
It does. You know, it's Lermo and Leaf Insect Man know what I'm talking about. It's a weird series. Weird Japanese series. Like, would you... If you were into someone, would you steal their clothes, their gym clothes, and bring them to your house? Then would you wear these clothes? Would you, when you're meeting up with someone else, would you wear their clothes?
You're getting weird, Kevin.
So it's like their clothes are on your body, like their skin had touched, are now touching yours because they had worn the clothes before.
Some people are really desperate.
And then you meet up with someone else, and then they said, "I'm going to out you."
Don't disturb Kevin's diary.
They're like, unless you wear those clothes, I'm going to out you that you stole their clothes. It's a pretty weird series. Oh, man.
I think I can understand why you've only hinted at it up until now.
Yeah, Kevin's reading pervert comics.
Well, that's what one of the characters accuses the main character of being. And I'm like, yeah, they're not entirely wrong, because you think when you would encounter this situation, you would just get out of it. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You would get rid of those clothes, put those clothes back once you had the chance. But the dude in this story never does. And then things get blamed on someone else, and then you just get stuck in, like, these weird contracts with other people.
There's a point where it would become his clothes and not be hers anymore. Right?
Yes, yikes. But then you get stuck in, like, some kind of weird love triangle.
Who publishes this?
It's Vertical. They publish a lot of different manga from Japan. Like, you usually get, like, the Dragon Ball stuff from Viz, and then you get the weird, more, I don't know if you would say, like, more adult stuff or, like, weird stuff. It's just so weird, because it has all the whole, you know, you're growing up in school, and there's a whole teenage angst built into it, but it does it in a way that a lot of other series I haven't seen it done. And they have the Flowers of Evil is actually, like, a poetry book, so that's where the name comes from, and the dude in the book, like, he's really into books. And he starts getting other people, like, into reading these books, or they find out, oh, what do you do? Oh, I read books and stuff like that. And some stuff goes down, and he has to move to another city. And then he just happens to, like, meet up with, like, other people, and they're like, into books, and he starts sharing his books with them. And then he finds out that one of them's writing a book, and the story they're writing about is, like, the same thing he experienced, like, being in a small town and, like, wanting to escape from it and thinking there's no way, like, out of that. Like, there's mountains surrounding their area, so they always wonder, like, what's beyond those mountains. It's just a very, very weird combination of ideas. And then he eventually meets up with some other people from his old life, and they're like, so you're not really involved with anyone right now, are you? Because you're just going to do the same things, like you're going to return to your old habits type of thing. Very weird. But somehow I can't stop reading. That's the thing.
Wild, dude. All right, that should do it for another episode of Indie Comic Book Noise. Hope Andrew's having fun at C2E2 without us. We'll have him back next time.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Nope.
No.
He quit on us.
No, don't say such things. If not, you can always get us over on Marvel Noise, the other show we do where we talk about all things Marvel Comics.
Except for this week, Andrew won't be there either.
And like our Facebook page and talk to us.
And
even if it's awkward conversations, yeah, and awkward,
like,
bike rides.
And circle on your calendar August 8th through 10th at the Seaport World Trade Center in Boston for the Boston Comic Con. I'm going to be there all 3 days, so come and say hi.
Kevin will be there signing autographs.
I will be?
He's going to be there.
Really? Cool.
Yeah. Should be fun.
But is there any awkward Japanese comics I can buy, though?
I'm sure. I'm sure there's a place for you.
Yeah, there's sadly always a place for him.
All right, guys. Thanks for spending some time with us. See ya.
I still have no ending to this show.
I froze.
Maybe you should stay with your mama. She could do your laundry and cook for you. Maybe you should stay with your mama. You're really kind of stupid and ugly too. Maybe you should stay with your mama. She could do your laundry and cook for you. Maybe you should stay with your mama. You're really kind of stupid and ugly too. You ain't really made for being out in the street. much hope for a fool like you. 'Cause if you play the game, you will get me. Maybe you should stay with your mama. She could do your laundry and cook for you. Maybe you should stay with your mama. You're really kind of stupid and ugly too. And you should never smoke in pajamas. You might start a fire and burn your face. Maybe you'll return to Managua. You could go unnoticed in such a place. We'll be right back.
mama. She could do your laundry and cook for you. Maybe you should stay with your mama. You're really kind of stupid and ugly too. And you should never smoke in pajamas. You might start a fire and burn your face. Maybe you'll return to Managua. You could go unnoticed in such a place. You ain't really made for being out in the street. Ain't much hope for a fool like you. Cause if you play the game, you will get beat. Patrick O'Hearn, Adrian Ballou, Tommy Mars, Terry Bozio, Peter Wolf, Ed Mann. Thanks for coming to the concert. Good night.